Hi, Laura Mafiotis here. Before we start this episode of Full Story, I want to tell you about The Guardian's newest podcast, Australia Reads. Each episode of Australia Reads will bring you an article that's picked by a Guardian editor and then read out loud. We're really excited to launch this because it's a new way for you to engage with and listen to Guardian Australia's best articles and reporting each week. We'll have new episodes every Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday, so make sure that you follow or subscribe to Australia Reads on whatever device you're currently listening on. Okay, here's today's episode of Full Story.
This is an extraordinary and important gathering.
I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story.
This summit is a gathering of Australians from many different backgrounds and experiences lived. It is a place for sharing.
This week, the federal government hosted a National Women's Safety Summit.
It is a forum for listening. It is a platform for change. Your stories, your expertise, your experiences are critical.
Held virtually, this was a platform for experts and advocates to discuss key issues around gender equality and violence against women and children, ahead of a national plan to address these issues that's due to be released by the government next year.
Right now, too many Australian women do not feel safe, and too often they are not safe, and that is not okay. There is no excuse, and sorry doesn't cut it.
But this event comes after a year where women and advocates have repeatedly claimed that the Morrison government's response to these issues favours words over action. And serious questions have been raised about whether Prime Minister Scott Morrison's own workplace, Parliament House, is safe for women. Today, is the Morrison government fumbling their response to a cultural reckoning on women? It's Thursday, the 9th of September. Murph, can you tell me a little bit about the political context in the lead up to this event?
Look, the government's been in some strife this year about its handling of women's issues.
Catherine Murphy is Guardian Australia's political editor.
And the summit, I think the government thought was an exercise where perhaps it could reset, where it could turn up, it could tell all the stakeholders, look, we know we haven't got everything right, we're listening, we're serious about implementing a better plan next time around, so let's have an event where you guys can be seen to be talking.
Of course, one of the key things that happened in the lead up to this moment was when former Liberal staffer Brittany Higgins came forward with allegations that she was raped in Parliament House in 2019. And I should make clear from the very start that a person has been charged in that case, and he has indicated that he will plead not guilty, and he absolutely denies these allegations or that any form of sexual activity took place at all. However, the Prime Minister has been critiqued for his response to the Higgins allegations and to the broader issues of sexism and gender inequality. Can you remind us broadly why? What has he done on these issues?
Well, if listeners could see me right now, I'm clutching my head in my hands. That's the sort of gesture I can give to explain what's gone wrong. Mm. Basically, in the whole sort of aftermath of Brittany Higgins coming forward with her allegation, the Prime Minister responded to the allegation by spinning and managing in a political sense when what was required was listening and learning. And that wasn't secret. That didn't happen behind closed doors. The Prime Minister stuffed up most days in public view. He just couldn't get his tone right. He just couldn't manage himself to a position where people could accept his bona fides, really, because he was so intent on the management. There was a press conference where he said he took advice from his wife.
Jenny and I spoke last night. And she said to me, you have to think about this as a father first. What would you want to happen if it were our girls?
I'm sure that statement was well intended, but it was just tone deaf and ridiculous. You know, a lot of women watching that statement thought, mate, why have you got to ask your wife whether this is okay or not? It's sort of like, how can you possibly get it that bad? Also, there was a lot of controversy around, which people will remember, which spanned several months, about whether or not operatives in the Prime Minister's office were backgrounding against Brittany Higgins or not. That triggered a couple of inquiries as to whether that was happening or not. Also, the context for all of this, I suppose, why this played so badly was there's been a discussion in Australia, particularly over the last couple of years, about whether or not the Liberal and National parties have a real issue with equality and with women participating in public life. That's the backdrop to all of this. This has been a political movement that's been hostile to affirmative action and quotas. It's taken a long time to sort of bring up the level of female cabinet representation, for example. There was also the sort of case study of Julia Banks, the former Liberal MP, who has written a memoir recently about her experiences as a former corporate high flyer in politics and how retrograde, I suppose, political culture was compared with corporate culture, which is really saying something. So that's the kind of backdrop to the issues that came to the fore in the first half of this year, and it put real lead in the Prime Minister's saddlebags when he was seen in full public view to be worried about managing the issue politically rather than using it as an opportunity to grow and to change.
Right, and this all kind of came to a head in March this year, where thousands of people marched on the streets around Australia, including in Canberra, for the March for Justice rallies. You were there that day, in the crowd, reporting. Can you remind us of what happened, especially in relation to Scott Morrison's response to this moment?
Well, it was a remarkable day. There were marches, as you say, right around the country, and there was a big march in Canberra that sort of spanned the whole forecourt ahead of Parliament House. Brittany Higgins made a surprise appearance at that rally, which completely electrified the crowd. It was an incredible event. Women, men, kids, all gathered on the forecourt, galvanised by this sort of crippling sense that we have case study after case study, yet nothing changes.
The system is broken. The glass ceiling is still in place, and there are significant failings in the power structures within our institutions. We are here because it's unfathomable that we are still having to fight this same stale, tired fight.
So it was, you know, it was quite a day, and Brittany Higgins made a very powerful speech on that day, which really resonated with the crowd.
Evil thrives in silence.
Grace Tame, a sexual assault survivor and the Australian of the Year, also addressed a separate rally in her home state of Tasmania, which was also pretty profound contribution as well.
Behaviour unspoken, behaviour ignored, is behaviour endorsed.
Right, and what did Scott Morrison do on this day?
Well, the organisers of the March for Justice had asked the Prime Minister to come down to address the rally on the forecourt and to be part of the event. Now, the Prime Minister declined to do that.
Well, I haven't had a habit of going out to any marches when they've come to Canberra side, because as Prime Minister, when you're in Canberra, it's a very busy day.
Although he did invite the summit organisers into Parliament House for a meeting, an invitation they flatly declined because the point was about coming to a point where a conversation could be occurred, not to have a closed-door discussion away from the cultural moment that was playing out around the country. So, again, that was another misfire. Some government MPs did show up. They were there expressing support and solidarity.
It is good and right, Mr. Speaker, that so many are able to gather here in this way, whether in our capital or elsewhere.
But the Prime Minister ducked it in question time.
And to do so peacefully, to express their concerns and their very genuine and real frustrations. This is a vibrant Liberal democracy, Mr. Speaker. Not far from here, such marches, even now, are being met with bullets, but not here in this country, Mr. Speaker. Not here in this country.
Which again was sort of one of those moments where you're looking at it and you think, mate, I know what you mean, but what on earth have you just said?
Yes.
It's sort of like, it was just extraordinary how protracted the missteps and the tone deafness was throughout this whole episode.
Yes.
And you could sort of see the Prime Minister getting more and more frustrated, more and more irritated, because in his mind he's trying to project that he gets it, but every time he opens his mouth it's a near disaster.
Since the Women's March, there have been some big announcements from the Morrison government around tackling sexual assault, harassment and gender inequality, not just in Parliament but in broader Australian society as well. Have we seen some genuine progress in the last couple of months?
Well, it's a bit mixed, Laura, but I'm going to say yes. I'm going to be rashly optimistic and say yes, because genuinely I believe there has been a bit of progress. In terms of the ecosystem I work in, which is Parliament House, there has been change. There are substantial, in the context of this building, things happening. We had a report by a deputy secretary in Scott Morrison's department, a woman by the name of Stephanie Foster. She recommended a bunch of changes. The critical one for parliamentary staff in the building was that they have an independent complaints mechanism and that they drift towards a more normalised human resources arrangement. Mm. Now that, I'm sure, for most people listening to us who don't work in politics, they would say, well, so what? That's just kind of bringing it everything into the 21st century. Mm. Yes, that's right. But in this environment, that's a really big deal. And frankly, I never thought I would see that happen. Mm. The government has also undertaken to implement those recommendations. There's a separate inquiry into parliamentary culture that's ongoing that the Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, is leading. Several hundred parliamentary staff have given submissions to that inquiry. For full disclosure, I have been interviewed by that inquiry. Mm. Separate to that, there's also, and this is sort of, I guess, on the less positive side of the ledger, sticking with Kate Jenkins, she had another separate process, which was before looking at workplace culture in Parliament House, that was looking at the prevalence of sexual harassment in Australian workplaces. Now, she produced a report, landmark report. That report found that sexual harassment is very prevalent in all kinds of workplaces. Mm. It made a bunch of recommendations, very substantial recommendations, about how that should change. The government has accepted some of those recommendations, but unfortunately, the principal recommendation, which was that all employers should face a duty, a positive duty, to basically provide safe workplaces for their staff in terms of sexual harassment, the government has not implemented that as yet. It's having further consultations about that. And Kate Jenkins, the author of this report, has made her views absolutely known on this point. She thinks the government ought to implement it and just get on with it.
Right. The way that the government has responded to Respect at Work has been fairly controversial, partially because of what you just said. There's been a key recommendation that hasn't been fully acted on yet. But also, is it not true that it took them quite a while to act on this?
Yeah, that was part of it. The government sat on it for the best part of a year. Now, in fairness to the government, the year that the government sat on this review was a really big year. That was obviously the first year of the pandemic. The government was fully extended. I understand, I suppose, given the bandwidth of the Attorney General was so extended during that period across a range of fronts, why it might slip. Mm. However, it's pretty crook that it slipped. And then when the government dealt with it, they basically have not ponied up to the central recommendation in the report.
And this happened only days before this summit this week. Is that right?
Let's think about, like, how you can have a sequence of cluelessness like we've seen in relation to this issue. So we have the government passing legislation, giving effect to some of the recommendations of Respect at Work in the parliamentary sitting period immediately before the Women's Safety Summit. Mm. And then the government sort of seems semi-astonished that a number of advocates said.
Excuse me?
Why did that happen? Exactly. Excuse me? Like, we're coming along to this Women's Safety Summit on Monday and Tuesday, and literally a couple of days before, you failed to implement the central recommendation of a report which is focused on keeping people safe in workplaces.
I mean, there's a whole panel at this summit about respect at work. Is that not correct?
There is. Yes, yes, yes. It was really sort of one of those completely dumbfounding things where, again, and perhaps we can get into this in a tick, but it's sort of like the government in its own mind is on a journey of growth here. The government in its own mind thinks it's trying to get better with this stuff. It's just the gap between this sort of self-soothing idea that, yes, we're listening, yes, we're growing, and reality is quite large. So it's sort of like we see this cycle where the government sort of appears astonished when people are critical of their responses, when in their own mind they think, hang on, like, you know, we're trying here.
We're doing such a top job. We're doing our best.
We're doing a top job. Exactly. So anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be funny if it wasn't terrible.
Next, the summit and the backlash. Right, so this brings us to the summit itself. As you mentioned, it was supposed to be Morrison's big moment of atonement, a moment to show that he gets the issues that the Australian public has been so agitated by and shown their feelings at the march earlier this year. Was it? Was it a moment of atonement for Morrison?
Sadly not. The Prime Minister was the keynote at the summit. I know there was some controversy around that. I suppose my counter-argument to that is I'm glad an Australian Prime Minister will front a Women's Safety Summit and make it very clear that this is a priority. In my mind, that's good. But I completely understand why people thought, particularly in the context of the rolling mismanagement of these issues, that it was pretty rich of the Prime Minister to be addressing delegates. Anyway, putting that to one side, the Prime Minister was trying to tell people basically, look, I get it. Women's safety is going to be a priority. It's going to be a priority of my government. But all around it, there was this sort of shadow summit playing out on social media where various people were making their views known about the event. Brittany Higgins certainly did. Grace Tame certainly did. A number of other advocates basically criticised, well, the Prime Minister's contribution and also some of the limitations of the summit itself. So again, in the Prime Minister's mind, this was your classic clean air moment where you're going to sail forth, you're going to say to Australian women, look, I'm trying to get this, I'm here, I'm making it a priority. But it was sort of drowned out basically by a lot of very respectable critique.
I wonder if we can step through specifically what the Prime Minister was saying at the summit. I mean, what were the key messages that you heard listening to his keynote address at the start of the summit?
His sort of primary objective, I think, in the speech was to tell people he was listening.
I want to hear from you, your perspectives, your ideas, your wisdom, for how we go forward on this together.
That he had grasped the stories of survivors, that he understood that.
Because with your help, we can create that national plan that sets a course for a country and a culture of Australians that does not like violence in the future, one that honours respect. That's our task.
And in the process, he referred to some stories of survivors that had come to him.
I've received hundreds of letters and emails from women sharing with me their stories, letters from women sharing some of the most anguished and personal experiences of their lives.
As the Prime Minister, people had written to him outlining their own experiences. Older women who had been assaulted in their youth and who had never spoken about those experiences. Mm. You can just imagine how profound some of that correspondence must have been. Morrison sort of littered that correspondence through a section of his speech.
I want to emphasise that, of course, some of the material I'm about to share and will be shared at this summit is confronting.
But in the context of survivors, a debate about consent, you know, trying to sort of give victim survivors agency and control of their own narratives and stories, again, that was a misstep. It's sort of like Morrison's point was, I'm listening, but how it read was an appropriation of stories that were not his to tell. I was incredibly moved by a number of contributions over the summit itself. In terms of Morrison citing those examples, if you're really going to grasp these issues, right, if you mean it, if you're the Prime Minister and you mean it, I've listened, I've learned, I'm trying to be better, you've got to take the time to get some fluency around the conversation and around the terms of the conversation.
Mm.
So to stand up in a forum of people working in this area and victim survivors and just rattle off some anecdotes, again, it's sort of tone deaf. You've got to, like, if your point is I'm listening, well, you've got to actually listen. I get what he was trying to do, but again, it was a fail.
Another key theme that I heard listening to this speech was this idea of respect, of coming together in respect and working to solve these enormous issues of gender equality. Can you talk me through Morrison's messaging on that and your response to it?
In politics, you call this big tent politics, right? You try and create a constituency for change that is supported by a number of different groups in society. I think, again, in Morrison's mind, this was a big tent politics pitch. He runs a Conservative Party. You know, women's safety isn't always front and centre for Conservative parties. Here he is. He's trying to say, look, I get it. I am across this contemporary issue. I'm leading my political movement and trying to build a constituency around change, right? That, again, is the objective.
So let us gather together in that sense of unity, in that sense of shared respect for each other, for what has brought us all to the table, acknowledging that's why we're each here. And let us use this good faith as the basis for our discussions and recognise and allow that good faith that has brought us together to provide the opportunity we are all seeking to move this forward through our participation here in this summit.
But there was also this sort of current of irritation through his speech. There was this section in his speech where he sort of referenced some of the critiques that were happening outside. He said, look, I get that people are agitated, I get that people are upset, but, you know, we're not going to succeed at this unless we sort of build that big tent, unless we all come together, unless we all collaborate, unless we all put down our weapons and work on the solution. We're not going to get the result, right? Which, again, was sort of a polite way of saying to people who were criticising him, his strategy, the limitations of the summit, he was trying to say to them politely, diplomatically, shut up.
Mm.
I'm trying to do something here. Let me do something rather than nitpicking all the frigging time.
Mm. Yeah, this unity message didn't seem to sit well with some of the women's safety advocates at the summit. For example, I was watching a panel featuring Thelma Schwartz, the principal legal officer at the Queensland Indigenous Family Violence Legal Service, where she called out the government for a lack of action and a lack of funding.
Violence against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and their children is a national crisis. It is a national shame. It is beyond disgusting. Year after year, we are begging for money, begging for funding to support our over 60-plus Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. You know, how is that acceptable? And government then has the heart to say to us, well, what are you doing? You know, come on now. Let's have an equal playing field here. If you're going to invest in us, you invest long-term.
But when it came time for Women's Minister Maurice Payne to give the closing address at the summit, she did seem to echo the Prime Minister's tone.
I'm absolutely convinced that a constructive, collaborative, and engaged approach across governments in this country, across service providers and community organisations and the individuals who perhaps can tell us the most, is the only way to progress the next steps out of a new national plan.
She was very forceful. She adopted a similar tone. It's like, well, this isn't a matter of politics. Women's safety is not a matter of politics. I want this to be bipartisan. I want this to be apolitical. Yet, you know, I sense politics here. I sense people are elevating things just to have an argument.
I would be deeply concerned if that nonpartisan approach was to be thrown away by some now for their own reasons.
And you could see her frustration as well, because it's sort of like, you know, in the culture of the Liberal Party, it will have been a big thing for Maurice Payne and Anne Rustin and others to put on this big event, to have the Prime Minister there, to be articulating these messages. But, you know, to be completely, to sort of have the whole thing become a point of rolling contention rather than any kind of catharsis. So you could see their irritation. That was the other element of the contributions over the 48 hours.
So it sounds like from what you've just said, alongside the core work of addressing women's safety, the government was thinking about their image, about how all of this would play to the public. What do you think of that?
Look, all of these characters, Scott Morrison, Maurice Payne, state safety ministers, women's ministers, look, self-evidently these people are politicians. There will be politics in politics. But the key gap here has been an empathy gap. All the way. Like, if we're going to distill this down, what's wrong with Scott Morrison? What's wrong with the way the government has presented during this debate? It's an empathy gap, right? At some level, these guys just don't get it. They're sort of lining up an equivalence, right? We've been politically inconvenienced by some of these more feisty arguments or debates that have been going on around the summit. We've been inconvenienced by that. That's not fair. We're trying to do the right thing. Why can't you acknowledge that we're trying to do the right thing? Why are you making these arguments all the time? Mm. What these guys don't seem to get is that victim survivors and the people who have worked their entire lives in this field, people who are in the field with women and kids every day, trying to keep them safe, they don't care if the Prime Minister's having a bad day at the office or if the politics haven't landed exactly the way the strategist wanted them to. Like, that for them is a complete non-issue. In order to close the empathy gap, you've got to get down in the trenches with these people. You've got to understand the realities of what they deal with every day. And it's sort of like two, what I've been trying to talk about in this episode is these two sort of seemingly irreconcilable worlds, the world of political management and the world of reality, where, you know, people endure terrible, searing experiences that change their lives. And the point of irritation that's built up in the country, in the culture, in the polity, is not about politics. It is not about that. And nothing will change until the most powerful people in the country understand this isn't about politics. This is about whether people are safe or not, whether people have equal opportunities to be safe, whether or not the justice system keeps them safe, whether or not the family court keeps them safe, whether or not services are in place in the right areas, in the right parts of the country, doing the right things. That's the difference between being safe and not. This is life and death. And this is what these advocates were putting before the government. Mm. So it's sort of like, we're not going to close that empathy gap until the government stops managing and starts listening.
Do you think that they will, and that we will see some more genuine change under this government and under the next?
This conversation is being taken seriously in a way that I've not really seen in my reporting lifetime yet. It's sustained, people are sticking it, People are taking it seriously. It remains a point of national conversation, reflection, thinking. Those environments are generally conducive to change. We've just got to hope that that's, you know, that's where we're at.
We reached out to the Prime Minister's office about allegations that his keynote address inappropriately used women's disclosures around harassment and assault. And a spokesperson for the Prime Minister responded, "All excerpts were carefully de-identified while also preserving the impactful voices of their authors, which are now shaping the national plan." That's it for today. Thanks to Catherine Murphy for her time. You can read her reporting on this, including the piece, "Platitudes and Sentiment at Women's Safety Summit Won't Cut It. When will the PM learn?" It's really worth a read. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, Jane Lee, Ellen Leibeater, and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design. It was mixed by Miles Martignoni. The executive producers of Full Story are Gabrielle Jackson, Miles Martignoni, and myself, Laura Murphy Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.